Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations.
It's the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. The Early Morning Late Show. Get your day started.
Hello and good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us today. It is Wednesday, October the 11th. And I want to start with a passage right from Psalm 62 that says, "Truly my soul finds rest in God. My salvation comes from Him." That's Psalm 62:1. Lots to be thinking of today, praying for. There's so much trouble right now with the folks in Northern California. There's now up to 17 deaths, which is called one of the worst firestorms in California history. It has destroyed as many as 2,000 homes and businesses, and about 20,000 people have been evacuated from that area. And they're not done fighting that. So let's be in prayer for those folks and the firefighters and the first responders and all the people that are now so incredibly displaced. Their lives were going along just fine, and all of a sudden, boom, home, business gone, and they have nowhere to go. So again, just want to be praying and being thoughtful for them. It's been quite a week, and we're going to have a conversation this morning with Dr. Cal Beisner, who I always look forward to talking to Cal because he's so passionate about everything he does. He's from the Cornwall Alliance, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Cornwall Alliance. He is the not only the founder and national spokesman, but it's a network of over 60 Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars, and they educate for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the good news of salvation by God's grace received through faith in Jesus Christ's death and resurrection. Boy, that says it all nice and succinctly. So we'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll get Dr. Cal Beisner in a conversation about what's going on with the current EPA regulations and some of the things that have happened, which we'll find out, I think, is going to be good news. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Good morning. So glad you're with us. Hope you slept well last night. Hope you're getting your day started with a nice cup of coffee and or whatever you like in the morning, and you're getting ready for your day. Thanks for being with us. Be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Welcome to the show. Bill Arnold here with you. Cal Beisner is a guy who paid attention in school and read his Bible a lot, which makes him a perfect guest for my show. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. So there's a little bit of good news in terms of regulations that have come out, thanks to Scott Pruitt and the Trump administration, regarding the Clean Power Plan. Do tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, for the last 10 years or more, we've not had very much good news from the EPA, the federal EPA, because it has constantly just kept ramping up regulations more and more tightly on all sorts of different things, way beyond the levels that were necessary for safety, for human health and well-being. And one of the ways that it did that was by imposing what the Obama administration called the Clean Power Plan. And what it really was an expensive power plan that had nothing to do with cleanness, because frankly, the only thing that it was really intended to regulate was the emission of carbon dioxide, which is really a wonderful thing. Carbon dioxide is it's an odorless, colorless gas that's non-toxic at more than 30 times the levels that we can possibly get in the atmosphere around us. And it's absolutely essential to life. Plants use it for photosynthesis, and they grow better with more of it in the air. And that means more food for everything that eats plants and everything that eats something that eats plants, you know. So that just makes the poor better off. But the EPA wanted to limit CO2 emissions in order to prevent what it thought would be dangerous global warming. Well, as it turns out, that the whole basis for that for that judgment is turning out to be false. Increasing empirical investigation shows that the warming effect of CO2 is real, but so tiny we probably can't even measure it. So, day before yesterday, the new administrator of the EPA under President Trump, Scott Pruitt, announced that the Trump administration is withdrawing that regulation. It is junking the Clean Power Plan, and that's super good news because what it means is that we will have less expensive electricity all over America because electricity generating companies and their plants will be free to choose whatever is the least expensive way they can to generate electricity while still having essentially zero emission of the really dangerous things that come from burning coal or natural gas, which are particulate matter, fly ash, and toxic gases and heavy metals like mercury. Those were already properly regulated to keep their emissions down before the Clean Power Plan. They still will be, so we'll have clean air and we'll have less expensive electricity.
This does sound pretty happy, Cal. I got to be honest. No, the Clean Power Plan was really targeted towards coal-fired power plants, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was part of what Obama himself described as a war on coal.
Uh-huh.
When Obama was running for president the first time around, he said in San Francisco that if he were elected, electricity prices would necessarily skyrocket because he's going to drive coal out of the business. He also said, yes, you can go ahead and start a coal-fired power plant if you want to, but I'm going to make you go bankrupt. That's not the proper job of government. Government's job is not to pick winners and losers in any given industry. Government's job is to make sure that there's a level playing field so that everybody plays under the same rules, and competition then can find out who can provide services at the best price. And that's especially good for the poor in the United States and anywhere else in the world because energy is essential to everything that we do. And when you make its price go up, you make it so that especially those who are poor cannot consume as much. And that's led to, for instance, in Great Britain and Germany, an increase in what are called excess premature winter deaths as electricity prices skyrocketed there because they adopted a strenuous policy of moving from coal-fired to wind and solar electricity generation. Their prices skyrocketed, and more and more people couldn't afford to heat their homes enough in the winter to keep from freezing to death. So they had, in Great Britain, for instance, their number of excess premature winter deaths more than tripled over the winters from 2009 to 2016.
Wow, premature winter deaths. I don't know if I've heard that before, so thank you for bringing that to my attention. Also, Cal, I'm excited to have you on the line right now because the listeners, probably many along with me, want to know this answer to this question. If we villainize CO2, how do we have a proper and civil conversation about the fact that CO2 is a good thing and then not get into an argument about too much is a bad thing?
Well, you know, too much anything is a bad thing, I guess, by definition, when you say too much.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is how much of CO2 is too much. And here's what we know. Right now, the concentration of CO2 in our atmosphere is about 400 parts per million. Every time you exhale, your breath has 40,000 parts per million CO2. So apparently 40,000 parts per million CO2 is not deadly, though an article in The Nation about a year ago actually called CO2 more deadly than the sarin gas that Bashar al-Assad used to poison his people in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
But no, CO2 is not a poisonous gas. It doesn't become a concern for people until it reaches well above 10,000 parts per million. And what that means is that we can definitely stand to go much higher than we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And for every doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere, say going from, say, the 270 parts per million that we had prior to the Industrial Revolution to 540 parts per million sometime late in this century we might reach. For every doubling, you get a roughly 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. Plants grow better in warmer and cooler temperatures and in wetter and drier soil, and they make better use of soil nutrients. They increase their resistance to diseases and pests, and they improve their fruit-to-fiber ratio. So all in all, it means everybody eats better, and especially the poor. That's what is my main concern in all of these things.
Yeah. Well, Cal, let me take a break, and I also want to ask, what about if you're exhaling after eating garlic? Is that more deadly?
Well, it might be deadly to your relationship.
See, again, you bring the answers I'm looking for, Cal. Let me take a break. More with Dr. Cal Beisner in just a minute. It's 15 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us.
All I want to do is praise your name, from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same.
Good morning. It's 18 minutes after the hour. I'm talking to Dr. Cal Beisner from the Cornwall Alliance. And Cal, it seems like before we went to break, you were basically telling me that, when someone is giving you the message about how bad CO2 is, you're actually doing more to harm the environment than just by saying nothing. So sometimes it's better to keep your mouth shut, right?
Well, yeah, you could say that if there were if that person were reading out the 40,000 parts per million of CO2 in quantities as to actually affect the entire environment, but they're not. And actually, God, of course, designed this environment in a wonderful way.
Mm-hmm.
The 40,000 parts per million of CO2 that person exhales becomes food for the plants around that person. We breathe out CO2, and that feeds the plants. They breathe out oxygen, and that feeds us. So it's a great symbiotic relationship that God has designed. And I just find it really, I think, strange that Christians should fall for the notion that God had designed a climate system so fragile that our increasing CO2 from 40,000ths of 1% of the atmosphere to, say, 60 or 80,000ths of 1% of the atmosphere could somehow cause disaster, catastrophe, warming so great that all the ice at the poles would melt and all the sea levels would rise super rapidly and destroy human civilization. I just think that doesn't make an awful lot of sense from a Christian worldview perspective. And then when we actually do the empirical measurements of temperature and compare that with the predictions of the global climate computer models that are used by those who say that we're causing catastrophic warming, what we find is that the models on average call for 2 to 3 times as much warming as actually observed, which means the models are wrong, and therefore they provide no rational basis for any predictions about future temperature, and also no rational basis for any policies like the Clean Power Plan or also the Paris Climate Agreement, from which President Trump announced back in June that the United States is withdrawing. And that's a good thing, too, because, frankly, implementation of the Paris Climate Agreement would have cost roughly $23.3 to $46.6 trillion per tenth of a degree Fahrenheit of temperature reduction by the end of this century. I'm not sure that's a good deal.
No, it doesn't sound like a good deal. So we've got these well-intentioned energy regulations and the impact of the government, but they're not very effective, and they're more damaging than effective, aren't they?
That's exactly right, and it's something that we as Christians really should be concerned about, because the whole purpose of government, as ordained by God, is to prevent oppression of those who are vulnerable, easily hurt by others.
Mm-hmm.
And, the folks who are the most vulnerable in this world tend to be the poorest folks. They don't have the resources to protect themselves. And so our governments should be adopting policies that protect the poor from harm of all sorts. And when you get a bunch of people in a particular industry, the renewable energy industry, solar and wind power, things of that sort, who manage to lobby government to adopt policies that pick winners and losers in energy production, the poor come out on the short end of the stick there, and I think that's not a good thing. That's the main reason why I got involved in this, is that I see so much harm coming to the poor around the United States and the world from policies like that. And that's why I'm so glad that Pruitt announced day before yesterday the withdrawal of the Clean Power Plan. I think it's good news.
Mm-hmm. Cal, how much of the opposition you get comes from a scientific standpoint versus an emotional standpoint?
Boy, that's a great question, because I think most people out there would assume that almost all of it comes from a scientific standpoint. My experience is exactly the opposite. The kinds of comments that we get, for instance, on our Facebook or in response to our Twitter feed and things like that, almost invariably, they're highly emotional, and there's rarely any awareness of the actual scientific evidence involved. So, you know, and I guess I shouldn't be terribly surprised at that, because, as you mentioned at the beginning of this segment of the show, you know, the Cornwall Alliance is a network of real scholars. We have a bunch of climate scientists who are fellows and senior fellows and adjuncts and whatnot for the Cornwall Alliance. We do really good scientific work, and so I guess people just don't really want to try to challenge us there, because, frankly, we've got the goods.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, though, if the ongoing debate on this subject is stuck there, where there is scientific evidence and then there is strong emotional response, and that's where a lot of the conversations begin and end.
Yeah, that tends to be the case. And I guess the challenge is how we move it off of that. And I think really, despite the fact that the objections tend to be emotional, you know, most of us really do try to let reason guide our conclusions on things like this. And so if we can get people to look at the evidence well, then I tend to find that they become well persuaded. And this is why Cornwall Alliance has just now released, in fact, we just announced it yesterday in one of our email newsletters, we've just released a new documentary video called Where the Grass is Greener 2, Helping the Poor Amid Climate Confusion. And this has interviews with about 30 different scholars from around the world, top scientists, top economists, top theologians and ethicists. And I think it's a great way to educate on this. And what we're offering this month is that anyone who makes a donation to the Cornwall Alliance of any size and requests this and mentions promo code 1710, that would be for 2017 and the 10th month, October, requests Where the Grass is Greener, we will send them a copy of this for them to be able to view themselves. And if they promise to pass one copy on to a science teacher at a school near them, we'll send them two copies,
Awesome. Totally
free. So they can do that at cornwallalliance.org just by clicking the button and then providing the information that we need.
Okay, Cal, that is exciting. Now, we only have about a minute left. And so I'm curious as to, you know, a better energy and environmental policy that we can start getting excited about. What would be one thing we could collectively go, oh, this would be great news if we could get this policy implemented?
Well, you know, I have no particular preference for any one energy source, any one energy technology, any one energy industry. I couldn't care less what we use, so long as it meets these criteria. It needs to be safe, and it needs to be economically competitive. It needs to be the cheapest way that we can get electricity and gasoline or diesel to users and still have it be clean and safe. And at the moment, and probably for the next, five, six, 8 decades or so, the way technologies are right now, at the moment, fossil fuels, coal and natural gas for electricity and oil for transport, are the most clean and efficient means we have. therefore the cheapest means that we have of providing that, and that's best for everybody around the world, but especially for the poor, those and nuclear. But I'm fine with seeing any other technology develop, and if wind or solar can become cheaper, great, we'll use them.
Yeah. Cal,
so
your
policy should be no favoritism.
Yeah. I'm excited about the CornwallAlliance.org and that video. I'm going on today to get it, and I appreciate you being a guest on the show. You're really awesome at everything you do, except I probably would guess I could beat you in ping pong. That's about it.
You probably can, Bill. Hey, thanks very much for
having
me back on the show. I always enjoy it.
Thanks so much. 27 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break, and we're going to hear from Ken Davis and Lighten Up. Be back in a minute.
Gonna clear up, put on a happy face.
Good morning. It's 31 minutes after the hour. So a woman gets pulled over in California for a DUI. And so the officer had her walk in a straight line. Then the officer instructed her to turn around. When she did, another officer, her boyfriend, was down on one knee with a little box open holding a ring. It was all a stunt. She said yes. So we're going to take a break for some more news, and then when we come back, Dr. Ken Kaiser is going to be with us. Be back in a minute.
How to tell him. Wipe off that full of doubt. Look, slap on a happy grin. And spread sunshine all over the place. Put on a
good morning. 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Tim Jennings wrote a book called The God-Shaped Brain, How Changing Your View of God Transforms Your Life. That was a book I actually read. Not all of it, but I read a lot of it. So the question is, why does the Bible tell us to renew our mind? Tim says it's because by default, we only look to our own interests and need to be transformed to be fully healthy.
Our minds, our bodies, and as Paul says in Romans 8, all nature groans under the weight of sin. We have a primary drive of fear in us now. We are fearful, and the scientists describe this with the words survival of the fittest, which is that drive to survive, to watch out for number one. And that drive is actually opposed to the primary principle that Jesus taught us, which is greater love is no man than to give his life for a friend, or this is how we know what love is, that Christ gave his life for us, and we ought to give our lives for each other. And that drive is the drive of God's kingdom of love, self-sacrificial love, but the drive to survive is the drive that says, you know, I'm going to kill somebody else to protect myself. And those are in tension, and when we experience the conversion experience and experience Jesus in our heart, it's perfect love casts out all fear, such that it says in Revelation 12:11, those ready for translation when Christ comes again, these are they who do not love their life so much as to shrink from death. And so we actually get a motivational change in the prime drive of our being, one that's primarily watching out for self and protecting self, to a drive that actually loves God and loves others and seeking to help and bless others with what we have to give to others.
That is a smart guy. I've interviewed him myself, and Susie has, and if you want to hear that one of his interviews in its entirety, head over to myfaithradio.com and type in Dr. Tim Jennings. So we'll take a little break, and Ken Kaiser has already walked into the studio with a 64-ounce glass of Mountain Dew, so it should be interesting. Be back in a minute.
If you're really serious about God, what would you be doing about it? This is Jim Garlow. There comes that moment in our Christian walk when we say, am I really in this commitment or not? It's like contemplating marriage. Oh yes, I'm going to marry her or I'm going to marry him. But until you're in that marriage, you have no idea how much commitment it takes. When we first come to Jesus, we're exhilarated. It's wonderful. Then we realize that there's opposition for loving Jesus, for standing firm for biblical values in a culture that says good is evil and evil is good. And it's hard. But we all must come to that moment, call it re-upping, when we say, I'm in this for the long haul. Here's my point. It's time to renew your vows to Christ in your life. It's time to re-up. There's more at jimgarlow.com. Be prepared to live out your faith.
You know the opening to Sweet Home Alabama where it says, turn it up. And Ken Kaiser's here, I want to say, turn it down. Well, I'm just saying, Kent, that's shocking music at this time of the morning.
I guess
the loud bagpipe music. Although it's a beautiful song. Original piece written by your bagpipe instructor. So I just want to say it's just great. It's just early.
It's early.
You'll admit to that, won't you?
Yes, I will.
But here you are in studio, and we've got lots to talk about, so let's get started. Do you want to start with Harvey Weinstein?
Yeah, this is a very interesting case, I think, because here's this guy who's been in business for a long, long time in Hollywood, and all of a sudden there's these allegations coming on me. Apparently they're all true, too, mm-hmm. From what we can tell. These actresses are coming forth and saying that he sexually harassed them or worse. It sounds like really rape in some cases. And I got to tell you, I was at the movies last night, you know, during the previews, there was one that had, you know, it named Weinstein Productions, and there was kind of a gasp from the crowd.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's something that a lot of people already know about. But Weinstein was a big donor, big donor to all kinds of Democratic causes. So both to candidates and to the party units and to PACs and other affiliated groups. And so Democratic politicians are kind of in a spot here where they have to say, well, what are they going to do with this money? And of course, a lot of the money's been spent from past campaigns, but we're talking tens of thousands of dollars that were given to Hillary Clinton's campaign and related entities and to Obama's campaigns and related entities. And so some of the current politicians who are currently in office, who have received money from him are giving it to charity and things like this. I did see where, for example, Minnesota's U.S. Senator Al Franken decided to give the contributions to a women's center here in Minnesota. And others are doing something similar, but they're all being asked. And it was interesting because Hillary Clinton was pressed by the media for days to make a statement on it. And I kind of sympathize with her in a way because, you know what? You know, she did take the money, but so did so many other politicians. But of course, they pressed her, and of course, they were pressing her because she had run for president. But you kind of feel a little bit sorry for her because here she is having to sort of make a statement against this this sexual harasser, and they were criticizing her for it taking her 4 days to do that, while it took her only minutes to criticize guns after the Las Vegas shooting recently. But it took her like 4 days, and I was thinking, you know, there's got to be some cognitive dissonance there for her because, you know, her own husband had engaged in similar activities with women over many years, and she doesn't even acknowledge that, and she had covered it up. If anything, she was an enabler of it. And but I guess some people say, well, she stood by her husband, but meanwhile, she didn't stand up for women in those cases, and now she was pressed to stand up for women in this case, and she did finally come forth with this statement, but it does have to create some kind of cognitive dissonance for her to be criticizing the one guy when she wouldn't criticize the other.
Mm-hmm. And it did take her 5 days to come out with a statement. It sounded a little bit like it had gone past a focus group.
Yeah, oh, yeah, for sure. No, you know, she didn't write it herself or something. And, it's like, how carefully can we write this so that, you know, we've done what we need to, but no more.
Yeah, I was shocked and appalled by the revelations about Harvey Weinstein, the behavior described by women coming forward.
Right.
Cannot be tolerated.
Right.
Huh. So, yeah, it's a tough situation.
So there's a couple of, if you parse it, I mean, and I do, because you're right, it goes through staff and so on. So she's not saying that the women experienced it, that they described it. You know, she's not saying that he actually did it in a way. But, I mean, it seems pretty clear with all the women who have said what happened that it must have. And it was going on for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's very interesting, too, to me, is for years and years and years, the actor Corey Feldman, who is a child actor, talked about how there are pedophiles basically raping child actors in Hollywood. And nobody believes him, or nobody takes it. Even if they believe him, they don't do anything about it, and they don't take it seriously, it seems. And I wonder if that now will be taken more seriously, or if there will be specific perpetrators named because, I mean, that seems to me that that's just as bad or worse than Harvey Weinstein. And, you know, but, I mean, Corey Feldman talks about how, you know, that it had an effect on him for the long term and on other child actors, too. And so you do wonder if we're going to hear more coming from the industry. It just, I don't know, it just gives you this look into what must be a really seedy kind of culture in Hollywood.
And is it about power? I mean, Harvey's got a lot of money.
Well, if you talk to people, I'm not an expert on sexual harassment or whatever, but that they say that that's what's really behind it. It isn't that there's actually something physical that they're interested in, but rather something psychological, which is, you know, that power over somebody else. Mm-hmm. And it presents as something physical, but it's really, in their psyche, it's about having power over somebody.
Yeah, and what about self-preservation? I mean, how many actors want to say, well, yeah, what about my talent? My talent got me to where I am today.
And well, right.
Harvey said either you stay with me in the hotel room or you go back to waiting tables.
Right. Well, and other actresses have talked about it. I mean, Kathy Lee Gifford came out and said that she, and this isn't even, you know, she was asked to a guy's house for an interview. And afterwards she thought, well, that was dumb of me to go to the house. And she was harassed there. And Gretchen Carlson is in the New York Times today talking about things that happened to her over the years. And that was in the news context, you know, when she was actually working in television news and she was harassed a few times. But it does seem to be about that sort of power play over someone else. And yeah, you're trying to move up in an industry and you want to do what you can to move forward. You don't want any barriers to it. And here you are with these powerful people who could potentially sink your career. Or short circuit your career, you know, it is a tough, very tough position to be in.
Well, there was an actress too who said that she knew of these exploitations from him years ago, but she said, I didn't say anything because it wasn't my story.
Well, right.
So in other words, self-preservation always remains at the top of everyone's list.
That's right. And I mean, when you look at somebody like him, he, you know, Weinstein had this ability to, you know, actually make somebody's career. I mean, he was known for that. He was known for being able to pick an actress or actor and bring them up from nothing.
Right.
And everybody wanted to be a part of that. And you think about all the struggling actors and things who are in Hollywood. I mean, if you think of all the famous people or the actors that you've heard of, there's, you know, 10 times or more as many of those who never make it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what they're doing to try and make it, you know, this is, you know, something that they kind of put up with, I think, because they know that they're not going to make it any other way.
Right. We're going to take a little break. If you want to jump in on this conversation, give us a call, 1-877-933-2484, or you can email me the question, bill@myfaithradio.com, 877-933-2484. We'd be happy to field a question or two. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back in a minute. Okay, we are back. It's 11 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Kent Kaiser is in studio. So, Kent, I was seeing a couple of clips. One was of Hillary. One was of Michelle Obama, really praising Harvey Weinstein, saying he is just an incredible human being. So what do we say about that, and what about people who are being endorsed? What do we believe anymore?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's like anytime they're getting the endorsement of somebody famous, you got to wonder what might be the long-term effects. And, of course, they're only saying that he's a great guy because he gave a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of people who are actually great guys who don't have a bunch of money who, you know, they're never going to say a peep about.
Incredible human being? That's what Michelle said.
Yeah, right,
Michelle Obama. How about what a generous man he's been hosting this party?
Well, that would
what
be
a generous.
More, that would be more accurate.
It would be.
But yeah, just the fact that he's giving money. And it's been, again, huge, huge money. It's tens of thousands of dollars. So you can see why they get all excited about having that money. But that doesn't make him a wonderful person.
Yeah. Well, I agree. So let's talk about some of the NFL massive tax breaks. Is that true? Do they really get huge tax
breaks?
Yeah,
President Trump tweeted about how they get massive. The NFL gets massive tax breaks.
Okay.
Well, yes, it's true. We have this experience wherever a new stadium is built, it seems. And not only do they get massive tax breaks, but they get generous tax donations, you know, given to them from the state. I can remember when we were looking at this new stadium for the Minnesota Vikings here in Minneapolis. First of all, there's incentives from different cities to try and get the stadium built there. So, you know, it's in Minneapolis, but there were outlying suburbs that were actually vying for it with various tax deals, tax breaks and incentives and so on. It wound up being back in Minneapolis where the old stadium was. But then, you know, the other thing that happens is that they estimate that it'll cost a certain amount, and the taxpayers will be on the hook for a big amount, and then it'll always wind up being more than what was projected. So, you know, when they first came in with an estimate of what the Minnesota Vikings Stadium was going to cost, it was going to be under $1 billion. Well, it wound up being over $1 billion, of course, and then the taxpayers are on the hook. And then they get all kinds of tax breaks where they don't have to pay taxes on you know, different aspects of the business for the long term. And so the president was absolutely right. They get all kinds of tax breaks and you know, they're wealthy owners. It always just seemed like a scam to me. And here's one way. Like, I can remember one time there was an official from the Minnesota Vikings who I used to have come in to speak in my classes. And he actually came in one time and talked about how the Minnesota Vikings had a scandal amongst the players. And he figured that before that scandal happened, that they were probably first in line in terms of getting a new stadium, ahead of the Minnesota Twins and ahead of the Minnesota Gophers from the University of Minnesota. And then they had this scandal and boom, moved right down to the bottom of the list in terms of priorities. Well, now that just tells you, if it's something like that can move them down to the bottom of the list, that means that we aren't even talking about the stadium being built on the economic merits or something. It's being built on emotion and the legislators having a goodwill toward the team. And so when they had that scandal, it destroyed their goodwill temporarily. And so they had to wait another 5 years. He figures it set them back maybe 5 or 6 years in getting a new stadium built. And again, that just shows you it's not based on economics or other merits. It's just all on emotion.
All right, Kent, answer this one. It's in Nevada, the public will be giving the Las Vegas Raiders $750 million in order to construct a new $1.9 billion 65-seat stadium from scratch.
Well, they're getting a deal compared to what we got here in Minnesota.
Okay, but let's just talk about the diminishing value of their education, because officials were faced with a budget shortfall of $14 million. That's approximately, if you do the math, 1.9% of what Nevada plans to give away for a new stadium. And what will the public get out of it? Not to mention these ticket prices are so expensive, it's out of most people's budgets.
What the public is going to get is larger class sizes for their students.
Totally.
Because, this little tiny, in comparison, budget shortfall is going to be borne out by cutting back on education. And they've said that. The class sizes are going to be bigger. And so the schools are the thing that's getting cut, meanwhile they're somehow finding all this money to give to the NFL owners.
We got a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about something interesting in terms of Bible smuggling into North Korea.
This is kind of
creative and
dangerous. It's a good news story.
Yeah,
you know,
let's end with that.
And yeah, it's a good news story. The creative ways that they're coming up with to get Bibles into North Korea, which of course Christianity is not legal, and it's technically legal to express your faith, but what happens is that you are arrested if you're Christian, or worse. And so people have to be stealth about practicing their faith if they are Christians now, and we really have to be stealth about getting the Bible in there so that people can read it, and other information too, by the way. And what they're doing is they're putting the Bible on flash drives, so they're very tiny, and then they're flying them in there on drones. They're flying them in there on balloons. Can you imagine tying a string on a balloon or whatever, or putting a flash drive in a balloon and then putting some helium in there and then floating it over? They're having these drops from drones and just amazing things that they're doing just to get the Bible mm-hmm. into North Korea, but it works. And people then, unfortunately, it's very difficult to be a missionary or something to North Korea or to proselytize, but what's happening is people are getting this information and then, on these flash drives and actually getting the word on their own, which it's almost like Reformation times or something where people are able to read the Bible on their own and then they become Christians by doing so.
Yeah, because the price you pay is a big one. I know there's, if you're a tourist and you try to leave a Bible there or do something crazy, you can be
years
in trouble.
Years in prison, at least. And then you, maybe the United States government can try to negotiate you out of there. I heard of one guy recently who was, it took 3 years.
Yeah.
Just crazy
he
what
left,
people do to
deliberately
try and read the Bible.
Concealed a Bible under a trash can in a men's room.
Right. Hoping that it would be found. This is the thing. It wasn't even for somebody specific.
No.
It was like he was just hoping.
Right.
I don't know that the custodian might find it or something like that. So it's just amazing what he was doing to try and get the word out.
Yeah. Yeah. And he spent 3 years in prison.
Right.
I'm sure they were nice prisons.
Ugh.
Good
yeah.
meals. You get
just
those little chocolates on the pillows at night.
Oh,
sure,
my
nice.
Goodness.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you know, the people in – this is the thing, too. That meanwhile, the people in North Korea, they're hungry for this. They're hungry for food. I mean, my goodness, like, you know, the leaders are starving their people, really.
Yeah.
And just, you know, but they're getting the word. So it's amazing.
Thanks, Kent. See you next week.
Thanks for having me on.
It is 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back in just a minute.
It's like favorite song that we love to sing.
Hour two is up next. We're going to start off with Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at MyFaithRadio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.